drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. Space is a vast and largely empty place. The occasional galaxy here, the random meteor there. But around the Earth itself, between satellites, space stations and debris, things are getting pretty busy. Nick Ryan is a composer and sound artist and he's been working to translate space debris into sound. I know, he's actually been doing that. And it goes a little something like this. Nick, welcome to the drawing room.
Thank you for having me.
Why space junk? Why did that attract your attention?
Well, it actually attracted the attention of a very good friend of mine, Kath Lakuta, who's an Australian-born filmmaker based in London. And she was reading the news one day, and she came across an article about a gentleman called Piers Sellers, who was a British astronaut working for NASA and infamously dropped an object on a spacewalk. He was scraping adhesive off the outside of the International Space Station on a mission called STS-121 in 2006. He was using a spatula to do this, and he accidentally dropped it, or it became untethered, and immediately became a piece of space junk. And Kath was captivated by the idea of this kind of mundane, as she saw it, kitchen instrument flying around the world at 4 miles a second. And she started to look into this kind of what we later called a hidden world of space junk and discovered that there was this incredible quantity of man-made rubbish floating around the Earth and some very poignant items, including a glove dropped by an astronaut called Ed White in 1965. And we both kind of fell in love with this idea of these sort of lonely human objects floating on their own around Earth. So we decided to make an arts project about it.
Did you take much convincing to come on board, or did you hear spatula in space and thought, I'm in, spatula
in
space?
She got me at spatula. I was actually, Kath is a filmmaker and she's interested, as many filmmakers are, in storytelling and humans. And she was interested in the sort of exploring the narratives and people and contradictions around space debris. I was interested in, as a sound artist, in somehow getting a better sense of space junk, because space junk, for those of us who know about it, and many people don't, we certainly didn't before the project, it's really kind of the domain of scientists and astrophysicists, and they know space junk in terms of statistics and telemetry. And the likes of you and I get news stories occasionally about how threatening it is. But other than that, we don't really have a sense of it, literally. It's very difficult to imagine space at all, let alone rubbish floating in space. And so I wanted to kind of portray it or represent it in a way that we could feel through our senses, because after all, that's how we kind of understand things to be real on Earth. And as a sound artist, sound is the sensory stimuli that I'm most interested in.
So how do you decide what space junk actually sounds like? Because there's not really sound in space, is there?
Absolutely. I mean, it's not quite a vacuum, but it's a partial vacuum. There's a tiny bit of atmosphere. But the molecules of gases at those sort of altitudes, 800 kilometres is where most of the low Earth orbit space junk is, doesn't allow for the mechanical transmission of sound. So even if we were sitting beside this space junk, it would be unable to transmit its vibration through the air to our eardrums. So it's never had a voice. It's voiceless. And I've kind of felt quite emotional about that and felt like it deserved a voice, especially given the tremendous energy that these particles have traveling at what's called hypervelocity, where if they impact with another piece of space junk, they can create disasters, let alone colliding with a spacecraft. So given that they'd never been voiced before, I thought rather than coming up with an arbitrary mapping, or sonification, as we call it, from size, for example, to a sine wave of different pitch, I decided to ask my friends and family and the public to collect pieces of rubbish on Earth for me, which they thought looked or felt like space junk in some way. And then what I did is I took all of these 1,000 items which ranged from pieces of tin foil to vintage camera parts to the odd more poetic item like a feather or a pebble or a piece of driftwood. And I generated sounds from all of these items using what we call Foley techniques, which your radio listeners will probably be familiar with, which is the art of making sound effects with objects. And this generated a sound bank of 1,000 sounds. And then the instrument that we built triggers these sounds every time a piece of space junk passes directly overhead.
So that idea, items that, you know, looked or they felt like space junk, it brought things that could never actually exist in space, but felt like they could.
Absolutely. And actually, the kind of collective consciousness of space among non-scientists is pretty accurate. It turns out that most space junk is metal, and most of the objects I was sent were metallic. And so I was sort of tapping into this kind of idea of the imagination that we all have of what space is made of. Space junk, human spacecraft and technology is made of. A lot of these objects in low Earth orbit, as well as being rubbish, are paradoxically representative of the pinnacle of human innovation at the time that they're launched. You know, they're the very, very latest future materials and technologies. Some of them are passive, surface materials. Some are active computer materials. So they are incredibly sophisticated. And I think that was also reflected in the objects I was sent. You know, people wanted to rip out the insides of cathode ray tubes, you know, anything that looked sort of technologically exotic or silver or reflective.
And have you kept the objects?
Yeah, they're all catalogued, actually. And there was a nice kind of synergy with that process, because one of the first things we made for the project was a piece of technology called an orbital mechanics simulator. And this takes a database of space debris telemetry, which is published to the public every week by NASA, or NORAD, which is the North American Aerospace Defense Command in America. And that's a list of 27,000 objects which are tracked on ground radar, and it's a snapshot of their current positions. And we had to invent some way of extrapolating their positions so that we could determine where they were, wherever we were on Earth, and, you know, what was passing overhead. My collection of terrestrial junk actually formed my own catalogue of space debris, a bit like the one that we get from NORAD. All of the items were labelled and named. And people seem to have a very kind of a great affection for these objects, which, after all, were previously just rubbish. The process of them sort of identifying them and collecting them and sending them to me was somehow quite romantic, and they each told me stories about where these things had come from, and they all took on a bit more value again.
So you have this library of sound. You've recorded, what, the 1,000 items. How does that become a composition, something more than just a sum of its parts?
Well, that's where the instrument comes in. So the instrument is called Machine 9, and it's an electromechanical phonograph. The phonograph, of course, was invented by Alexander Graham Bell. It was and it was a cylindrical wax cylinder, later made of shellac. And it had a needle on it, which would travel up and down the cylinder, much like a needle on a vinyl record player travels across the disc. And that sort of reproduction of sound, that kind of mechanical amplification of a waveform engraved into a material, was the first way that we could actually record and play back sound. So I wanted to sort of use something that was very tactile like that to play back these sounds, because after all, what I'm trying to do is to create a physical relationship with the listener with a piece of space debris. So the instrument is a giant version of an Edison phonograph. It's 1.5 meters long, and it's not made of wax. It's made of aluminium, a piece of aluminium gas pipeline. And it's highly polished. It's covered in a thin lacquer, which gives us something to engrave. And Dave Cranmer, who was the engineer who designed this and built this for me, managed to devise a way to create 8 stylus carriages, each of which is responsible for 125 grooves. And they can travel up and down the cylinder and play any of these grooves. The grooves, or the sounds, laid onto the cylinder are engraved in pitch order. So like a piano, it has a register as an instrument, low frequency on one end, low sounds, and high sounds at the other. And as space junk comes overhead, a 600-kilometer hole in the sky above the instrument, one of the styluses will play a sound for each object that passes overhead. What sound it gets played is determined by the radar cross-section of that object, which is mapped to the pitch of the sound. So the full pitch range of the instrument is scaled, if you like, to the full size range of debris objects in the sky.
On RN, I'm Patricia Carvelis, and Nick Ryan is my guest in the drawing room, and we're talking about space junk. You launched Adrift. It's the movie you did with your colleague at the Royal Astronomical Society. How did that come about? Did you have to be invited?
We invited ourselves, actually.
That's my favourite kind of invite.
Yeah, I mean, we were very, very welcomed by them. But they actually didn't know about the project until we knocked on their door. We were sort of under the radar for a while. But we were sponsored by an arts organisation in the UK called The Space, which is very confusing because it's not got anything to do with space. It's a space for digital art. But they kind of opened lots of doors for us. And one of them was the Royal Astronomical Society, a beautiful building next to the Royal Academy in London. And we managed to squeeze Machine 9, which is incredibly heavy, in their glass elevator without smashing it, and took it up to the fifth floor of this beautiful building and set it up for our launch. And we were surrounded by artifacts from the history of astronomy, including some beautiful paper globes. So it felt very apt to launch it in that space. And it's subsequently been shown at the Science Museum in London and also at WOMAD last year.
You've mentioned that there are literally thousands of atoms drifting around, you know, up there in space. Does that matter beyond the potential for art? Should we be concerned about the way that we're treating space?
Absolutely. I mean, Kath and I, throughout the project, were careful to point out that our work was not about activism, despite the fact that we care very much about this part of our environment. We were seeking to sort of draw attention to it by creating a more poetic interpretation of the issue rather than, you know, being on the nose about it. And we felt that kind of by creating an emotional connection with the issue, people might sort of think more about it. However, it was described by our scientific advisor, Professor Hugh Lewis, who's the head of astronautics at the University of Southampton. He describes it as one of humankind's most pressing crises. And it certainly is. We don't tend to think of space as being part of our environment, but of course it is, and it begins incredibly close to Earth. You know, some of these objects are as low as 160 kilometers away, which is just down the road, and yet it's a very different and very hostile environment. It's every bit as much of our environment as the ocean is, which of course is also full of rubbish too.
What surprised you the most when you were creating this? Did anything end up topping the spatula?
There was a Russian space suit which was pushed out in 2006 again by some astronauts on the International Space Station with the intention of allowing people on Earth to connect to it via long-wave radio, and it had a radio transmitter in it. Unfortunately, the radio transmitter failed, and it shortly after being launched, it burnt up in the atmosphere a few days later. But we loved this kind of idea of this empty silver spacesuit floating around Earth. There's a constellation of copper needles which were released, I believe, in the 70s to try and improve radio communication on Earth. They were intended to bounce signals back to Earth. And they're these beautiful, long, thin copper needles flying around like daggers. I believe from hearing from astronauts that crystals of urine also exist, frozen urine ejected from the International Space Station, which look particularly beautiful as the sun passes through them. There are all sorts of things, rocket boosters, flecks of paint, ammonia tanks, thermal blankets, all sorts of stuff.
Nick, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Nick Ryan has been my guest in the drawing room. He was in Australia as a guest of the Mona Foma Festival.